Welcome to Abstracts. This week, social media.
You're being subtly manipulated by algorithms that are watching everything you do constantly and then sending you changes in your media feed and your diet that are calculated to adjust you slightly to the liking of some unseen advertiser.
The unintended consequences of a network when it grows to a billion or 2 billion people and it literally changes your relationship with society, with each other. God only knows what it's doing to our children's brains.
Consumer internet businesses are about exploiting psychology. You know, people are unpredictable, and so we want to psychologically figure out how to manipulate you as fast as possible and then give you back that dopamine hit. We did that brilliantly at Facebook. Instagram has done it. WhatsApp has done it. You know, Snapchat has done it. Twitter has done it. So there are great examples. WeChat is doing it. There are great examples of failing fast is the right path to exploiting psychology of mass populations of people. It literally is a point now where I think we have created tools that are ripping apart the social fabric of how society works.
As soon as I spend a little bit more, because we had a conversation about this, but I'm spending a little bit more and it's just not paying off.
It's the little bit more. You need to just make the leap. It's got to be like, you know, £12, £13.
This was literally £13.
Was it?
Yeah.
Maybe you just need to let it breathe a little bit. You did pop it and it's not corked, is it? It's screwed.
No, apparently screw tops are much better these days, though.
Really?
Yeah, I was reading about it. You shouldn't have too much of a thing against screw tops anymore.
No?
Apparently not. The bottling techniques are much better these days. So, for most wines, it's fine. Apparently.
Really?
Yeah.
I have no idea.
Nor did I.
I still prefer cork.
I like the whole experience.
It's a ritual.
A barman's mate out and just...
That's it. Giving it a twist, like popping it out of it. You know what I mean? There's no joy. Yeah. There's no joy with a screw top. No. Feels like a shit beer. Even beers you have to pop off. You know what I mean? But, you know, wine, no.
No. But much cheaper than the £30 bottles of gin we were getting, plus tonic, plus garnish. Gosh.
Yeah, and maybe we won't be so ruined.
No, after half a bottle of wine, we'll be...
Pretty on the way.
Pretty,
but
yeah.
In a nicer way.
We'll be merry. We'll be happy.
Very, very merry. So welcome back, everybody, to Abstracts. We are back in the age of COVID. Abstracts in the age of COVID. How was your COVID lockdown, Matthew?
I've got to say, mine was interesting. Mine was fairly by the book. My partner is half German and also has a law degree, so it was very by the guidelines.
Right.
So lots of internal contradictions.
You practiced social distancing.
We did. We tried our best to do everything by the book, but ended up having a European summer. Very by the book.
Your summer was great. You went away. You managed to escape the UK.
We did. Went through France, ended up in Greece, and then back through Germany.
Fantastic.
Very, very nice. What about you? How was your experience?
Solitary. Solitary it was. I did book to go away to Iceland, but wasn't able to go because of exams, which was crap. Because, I had exams that only got scheduled after I booked my tickets. So... that was annoying. And it was, you know, a case of one of them things with flights. Change them or don't change them, lose your money, whatever.
Yeah.
But it was all right. I got through by playing a lot of Counter-Strike with other people. So that was my social connection. That was my social media.
Yeah, you invited me to some of these matches.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
See, I struggled. There was too many people on there.
There was. It got crazy for a while. But now there's like a solid core, I'd say about five.
About five.
Who still play. So it's still pretty good. But without that, it would have been like really crazy, man. I was very lucky though, very, very privileged because, you know, I wasn't furloughed. I have employment, so I was still getting paid all the time. I live by myself, so that's great. You're not stuck in with somebody who you hate and hates you or, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
So yeah, all in all, it was good, man. I'm glad to be back at work though.
Yeah. When did you start?
A month ago.
Okay.
A month ago. Frontline worker, mate. So, what did you do? Did you watch box sets?
So, during lockdown, lots of cooking like anybody. But once we were away, it was family. Family in France, family in Germany. So, we were on the road. It was quite interesting watching the different measures and how different cultures reacted to that. You know, watching the French you know, with their lubies, you know, kissing on each cheek, and going from that to total social distancing, pretty much the compromise was handshakes. I was seeing handshaking everywhere. I was like, well, I guess they're socially distanced in comparison to doing lubies, but so we, you know, we saw a lot of that. It was very interesting. Went through Marseille before and after it became a red zone. Very little compliance to any red zone measures. People meant to be wearing masks. There was barely any compliance with that. It was very, you know, watch it. You could see into nightclubs, people shoulder to shoulder. I mean, it sounds fairly bleak, but in Marseille, there was very little compliance. But then in other French cities, for example, you had very diligent people wearing their masks at all times. So it was very interesting going through the different cities and seeing how everything was playing out. And then also going to Crete, because it's a very tourist-heavy destination. Lots of German tourists.
Yeah.
And then seeing how that was, you know, a curfew was put in place on hospitality venues, and that was actually because there's a large hospitality industry in Crete. Everything had very stringent measures. You know, it was actually the businesses putting measures in place proactively before the government was putting guidelines in place.
Well, to stay open, isn't it?
Yeah, it really matters to them. That's their entire economy in Crete, and so actually, my experience was seeing something like best practice in Crete and then coming back to Europe, well, the rest of Europe. So, yeah, it's been very interesting.
It has indeed been very interesting. You spent any time on social media?
Yeah. You know what? I've tried to...
During lockdown, I mean, did you find yourself on it more than normal? Do you use it very much anyway?
I used to spend a lot of time in it. I've wasted entire weeks of my life, I'm sure, just in social media, just these rabbit holes.
Yep.
I've ended up on YouTube recommendation rabbit holes where, you know, thankfully never became a flat earther, but I'm sure it's pulled me right, it's pulled me left. I've been all sorts of extreme things.
Yeah.
You know, you open up a new account and you start watching different YouTube videos to go, what do the other side believe? Next thing they think I'm a white supremacist just because I was looking for some right-wing material just to balance out my left-wing views.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, you get down a lot of rabbit holes.
Crazy, endless scrolling, people's silly pictures, people's silly opinions. When I did use Facebook, I got involved in so many just stupid, endless, just, you know, back and forth, just like wasted days doing that. You know what I mean? It's incredible. But yeah, not anymore.
No, not me and anymore. You both now.
Oh, are you off now?
Yeah, deleted.
Well, that was it. Like, I deleted Twitter. When was it? I think, like, honestly, I deleted it about a week after that everything happened with George Floyd.
Oh, really?
Spent about 6 days. It was about 6 days after that I was like, I can't take this anymore. Because it was like, I didn't know what to do. It was part of lockdown that I just didn't know how to spend my time. I'd never really spent too much time on Twitter, but everybody seemed to be, that's where the news was. And I'd had an account for a few years, but never really got into that whole Twitter sphere. So that was super easy to delete. And everything that started happening is like during COVID and during lockdown, it just made me feel sad, man. I spent about 7 days on it, just uncurated bile of just people's opinions and videos and just horror.
The negativity.
Oh.
Sandwiched between cat videos.
Yeah.
Of course. But like the general pervasive negativity of those platforms was quite overwhelming. And actually cutting that off, I didn't delete the account back then when I was in lockdown, but I did try and come off of it as much as I could, and actually just getting outside once a day for my daily exercise, getting out, seeing the outside world, turning the phone off was really, really important.
Yeah, definitely. Mm. But turning off Twitter, as I say, was much easier because I'd never used it. And I'd sort of played around with deactivating Facebook. I deactivated it for a month in there, but then dipped back in.
What made you keep it open?
I guess, well, the podcast, actually, because, you know, we had the page. And I didn't know whether I needed to keep it active because of... I don't really know. I'm not very good at using it.
You're trying to blame it on me, huh?
Yeah, pretty much.
I made a page for the podcast.
It's your fault. Yeah. And all you listeners as well. But no, well, that was one thing. It was like all my pages and, you know, I used to make films and I didn't know if all that was gone. And I guess I still cared about that. Now I just don't. So it's like... now that is under full deactivation, so it's currently in its 30-day deletion cycle.
Is it?
So yeah, I'll be totally zero social media. Well, I do have the Instagram, but I never use it. It's like I never press it on, so I just need to delete that.
Yeah, why do you have it?
Well, yeah, I might just delete that right now. Well, no, I can't do it right now.
We'll be right back.
We'll be right back. No, but yeah, that's it. But I don't have the app on my phone for Instagram. So I think it's just one of those things I'll just get rid of, delete it eventually.
You effectively don't have Instagram.
Effectively don't have it, yeah.
But
I do, again, play Counter-Strike. So I do use Discord. That's kind of social media.
Yeah, but then to the extent that WhatsApp is social media, I think...
And I do have WhatsApp.
I would draw a distinction between these messaging services and group chats. And then between social media.
Sure. So, yeah, I did find a few papers that said it is important to make that distinction between, say, like a forum and Facebook.
Yeah.
And, you know, chat rooms like Discord. Because, you know, different things serve different things. And for all, you know, I love shitting on social media, there are some benefits. I did find papers that do have some benefits, you know, like people finding belonging in groups and whatnot and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, finding organ donors. I mean, there's all sorts of positive things that social media has done for us.
Absolutely. Loads and loads and loads. And it's interesting that we come to social media because we have been talking about doing it for a while, and it's been, well, since human experimentation.
Yeah, we did a
really,
two-parter on that, and when we signed off the second pass, it was, well, it was basically prophesying that we'd do this episode.
Drunken prophecy.
Yeah.
We
said, what are the social media companies doing with our data?
And that's exactly it. And with our brains. And I've never felt so vindicated than when The Social Dilemma was released.
Absolutely.
Just a few weeks ago, which I didn't know about until you introduced it to me.
Yeah, so actually, The Social Dilemma released on Netflix, and it largely features people from the Center of Humane Technology and Tech Insiders. And so I was following the Center for Humane Technology, which is headed by Asa Raskin, who you may know him as... Well, you won't know him, but you'll know the infinite scroll mechanism on your Facebook.
All right, so like it never gets to the bottom.
Never gets to the bottom, yeah. That was him. Asa Raskin and Tristan Harris. Tristan Harris was a design ethicist at Google. And he worked on Gmail, for example, and lots of internal projects like that. And they founded this Center for Humane Technology. And they were publishing this, or they were shouting about this documentary on Netflix. And my God, I mean, you can go into the heavy academic research on this. You can go into, you know, that avenue. But if you want a quick overview of what social media is doing to us,
sure,
what it's designed to do to us from the mouths of the people who designed it to do it to us.
Sure.
Like, for example, the director of monetization at Facebook, or the former director of monetization, who specifically, he was the one who chose advertising as their model.
Right.
If you want it out of their mouths, what's being done to us, watch that documentary. It's very, very well done.
You know, these guys, when they were developing these platforms, they stumble across these things, don't they?
Yeah.
These things that work. And you see this actually in the literature. Papers from around 2003 up until about 2014, you know, there's nothing really in there. They just fail to acknowledge, like, really any kind of negative to using social media. Because things like the like button, things like reactions, things like interactions, you know, these things are only just starting to happen.
Mm.
This understanding of social media's ability to tap into our little habit centers, like very, very deep in our brain, in our central nervous system, they're figuring this out as they're kind of going along.
Yeah. It's really interesting. I mean, there's people in the documentary like Justin Rosenstein, who's the co-founder of the like button. Or the co-inventor,
right.
Which is crazy because when you start thinking about it, like the like button had to be invented.
Yeah.
So the co-inventor of this basically said that he was just looking to spread love and positivity in the world.
Yeah.
I mean, that was the express intention behind the like button. But
the like button as well, I read itself was influenced. Well, the first one was Vimeo. Vimeo put the first kind of like version of a like on their thing. And it was supposed to be like, there was a website called Dig It.
Yeah, Dig.
And you had like digs or whatever.
Yeah.
So it was based
essentially
on
upvotes.
Digs. Yeah. Exactly, upvotes. And I guess it was supposed to be based on that initially.
Mm.
But they found this whole, it's like Pandora's box.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is when it's in the direction of the business interests,
then
it gets kept. But when the very engineers flag these things as having unforeseen consequences, well, you're not going to get the company to let you change it back to take these things offline to rethink them if it's now against shareholder interests, if it's against the company's interests. So a lot of this is people doing good work trying to improve the user experience, same as the infinite scroll mechanism, a nice user experience And then the unintended consequences come in. They start shouting about it internally, but it gets kept because it's addictive.
It's now an intended consequence.
It's now an intended consequence. And yeah. Then this is why these people leave these companies, because they create something, it gets used for ill means or ill purposes, and then they're obviously very unhappy about this. So you can look at Facebook and go, well, they've got evil intentions. A lot of the time, there's a business model underneath it, there's shareholder interests underneath it, and there's people with good intentions just working in these companies. And unfortunately, this is how we end up in the current climate.
Hmm. So the Center for Humane Technology, it's great that they've really come along, because this is something that I definitely think is an issue, that we definitely think is an issue, certainly. But when I was researching this, I'm so against social media. Just it freaks me out on an internal level now even more than it did when I started coming out of it.
Yeah.
I deliberately tried to look for research that was, well, maybe it's not all doom and gloom, you know, even though this documentary is coming out. Maybe these guys are just a bunch of bad actor coders and, you know, shitting on Zuck. Yeah, and Zuck's the nice guy. You know, Mark Zuckerberg's the nice guy here.
Maybe.
You know? Maybe. So I started to try and find research that disagreed with me, really, or that could kind of prove me wrong, or that you know, it wasn't all this kind of doom and gloom. And, you know, people are trying. People really are trying to deny, in a way, now, the gravity. in this kind of situation. Even just one example of this, I found a paper from 2020. It tries to dissociate the amount of time you spend looking at your screen with any well-being issues.
So they're trying to correlate screen time with all sorts of outcomes.
Right.
But they're not telling you, well, the screen time spent on Facebook versus screen time spent on, you know, maps because you're going to meet your friends, or screen time spent messaging people, or screen time. They're not.
Exactly. The actual usage of the technology is not being discussed here. It's just like the amount of time. Now, of course, like Jean Twenge, which is, you know, she's influenced quite a lot of our work. She says time's really important, but it's important because of the time you spend doing various things. Mm. So just talking about time isn't really important. But this is an 8-year longitudinal study that they did release this year. It was comprised of interviews, a single interview and two questionnaires once a year, given to, I can't remember how many participants there were, but there were a number of them. And they were allocated randomly to begin with. They were trying to get people under the age of 20. And they were allocated randomly, and they went and interviewed them and gave them questionnaires. All of this is self-report. One of the questionnaires was for anxiety, and that was just a 6-item scale. So a 6-item scale means there's 6 questions. And the questions were like, when I have a problem, my heart beats really fast. 0 to 4. 4 being yes. Really yes. Then they had a depression scale. That had 20 things for an adolescent. Questions like, I was bothered by things that don't usually bother me. And then we have time spent on social media, where they were asked to self-report whether it was 1 hour. Well, between 1 and 9 hours a day.
Oh my good lord. They self-reported their time spent on social media.
All of them. All of those measures.
They're self-reported, anxiety, specifically that as well. I mean,
yeah,
wow.
Yeah. Self-reported time. Now, that's ridiculous.
That's ridiculous, because one of the clear things is that people do not realize how long they spend on social media. You ask,
right.
When you ask people how long they spend on there, they might say 1.5 hours a day, and then you look at their screen time on Facebook, for example, when you look at that, and it's like 3-4 hours a day.
Exactly.
People don't realize how long they spend it. That's very well known.
And that's another part in the social dilemma. They draw attention to that. One of the actual researchers in their own kids draw attention to that. Mm-hmm. So we know that that's kind of a load of rubbish. Self-report in general is just a load of rubbish, right? If we're honest about it. Unless you're being extremely specific about a specific thing, self-report is not reliable. So they did this study over the course of 8 years, where they did an interview and the questionnaires once a year. And then when they'd finished, they rearranged their data, right, in a fashion that just lined up all the ages of the participants. So they put all the 13-year-olds together, all the 14-year-olds together, all the 15-year-olds together. They didn't do it by the year they were interviewed. So this is a problem, because different iterations of Facebook and social
never
media
mind the
happen
fact
all the
it seems
time.
To change 3 times a year,
right?
Iterating on all sorts of different versions of the platform.
Right, so it's not the same Facebook year after year after year for those 8 years. And they line up all the age groups, and where they don't have the corresponding age, so people might have been 17 when they were starting the study, so they wouldn't have 13 to 17. They did some mathematical sum where they fill in these values to make the formula work. That's called a
best guess, I guess.
Yeah, best guess. Well, an M plus it's called. Yeah, now, I'm not a mathematician. I don't know whether that you can do that, but they did do that. And they came to the conclusion that there was no relationship between social media use and any form of well-being, whether that was positive or negative
that's
or anything like that.
Absolutely mad.
It's just, and this is 2020. And they actually, they cite previous papers, one of which is a narrative review where they say, they actually say that this narrative review says the link between mental health and social media is tenuous, mixed and tenuous at best. But this is just an absolute misrepresentation.
Mixed and tenuous. Would you like a top up of the wine?
Oh, I would, absolutely. What wine are we drinking, by the way?
Merlot, it's a Bordeaux. Calvé.
Le Bordeaux.
It's a 2017. How are you finding it? Now it's aired out a little bit.
I like it.
Yeah, it's nice, like isn't it? We've decided to... we've changed. See, things have changed since the last podcast, you see. It's not gin and journals anymore. It's red wine. And this is, I don't know, largely due to my time spent in Europe, I think. I went back to work and people said, you seem different. You seem European. Whatever that means. I mean, that's horribly nonspecific. It's like, that's the typical English response. You seem European? What the fuck do you mean?
You're Euro-trash.
But yeah, red wine. Cheaper, nicer, proportional to the price. Because that gin never tasted £30. It never tasted £30. If this is apparently £13, it's not a proportional.
It really isn't.
Experience.
No.
So,
and this might give me a good opportunity to go to my local wine shop that I just found down the road that does like some really good stuff.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Are you going to blow me out of the water in the next episode?
Absolutely. Then? Do that in 2 weeks' time. But yeah, back to this 2020 paper. It's just... What's really annoying about it is it tries to conflate time with social media. This is the real problem with it. But time is not the same as social media. So it concludes that time spent has no effect on well-being, but it doesn't say what you're doing on there, how you're interacting.
It doesn't control for activity.
Right, absolutely. Okay. What's even crazier is that, like I said, it makes this statement here, and this is a direct quote. Recent meta-analysis suggests that the link between social media and mental health is mixed and tenuous at best. All right, this is in 2020. Just got published. One paper it cites absolutely does say that. That's literally what it says. This was Hank Huang in 2018. But even this paper itself is kind of crazy because this person took 67 studies that when they were all stuck together that comprised 19,500 participants and found absolutely nothing. And like no link between social media and feeling good, no link between social media and feeling bad. It's saying like the mean correlation between time spent on social networking sites and psychological well-being was low, with a low R number. I'm not going to go into R numbers.
Wow.
The correlation between time spent on social networking sites and positive indicators, self-esteem and life satisfaction were close to zero. This is in 2018.
Yeah,
and so out of 19,500 participants, that's like testing 19,500 smokers and not finding one person with cancer.
Yeah,
that's a miracle.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
It's an absolute miracle. Now, the second one that they say says that the link is mixed and tenuous at best is a narrative review from 2014 from the UK University of Ulster.
Okay.
Now, this is not what they said at all. I searched that paper for the word tenuous and it is not in the paper. It's absolutely not in that paper. So just to contextualize this narrative review, this was in 2014. And at the time, there's actually quite some interesting information in it because at the time it says that 89% of 18 to 29-year-olds used social media at that time in 2013. And Forbes reported that that was representative of an 800% increase since 2005. So over the course of 8 years, usership rose 100% a year.
Mm.
And I can't think of another product that does that or so that did that.
Doubles every year.
Doubles. No, 100%. Yeah, literally. Yeah, every single year and continues to grow.
You know what does do that every week? Coronavirus. When it's exponentially growing. So you're saying that Facebook is a virus.
Yeah, well, there you go. Mm. There you go. And so what they did was their meta-analysis took people kind of under the age of 20 because social media didn't really start popping up until 2003. And they say that, yeah, sure, there's some benefits versus limitations. They didn't really find any notable benefits or notable limitations across 15 studies, but none of those studies talked about platform interaction. They were not talking about that. Then it does outline some positive outcomes, like people who feel like belonging to a group and they're more likely to kind of seek help for various problems and whatnot. But this study is full of self-criticism. They literally say, and this is a quote, right? There was an overrepresentation of cross-sectional survey-based research recognized as a weaker research design in relation to the research question, for which experimental designs are notably stronger.
And just for anyone who's listening, cross-sectional essentially means just taking basically one point in time.
Yeah,
it's not across time, it's not over time, it's just you're taking one point in time.
Exactly, one point in time. And it says here, and I've emboldened it, it says, in the face of such evidence, one is unable to distinguish various mitigating factors such as gender, socioeconomic status, geographical locality, etc., on adolescent online social networking and well-being, much less the impact of online friendships or specific online activities. That is not the same as saying the links are mixed and tenuous at best.
This is just junk research.
Just absolute junk. This is 2020.
So let's rewind 6 years. Facebook is publishing studies with academics on emotional contagion.
Exactly. And this, just to finish off what this paper says,
that
leads exactly to that. It's like, research is thus moving away from variables relating to intensity of use and is shifting towards the impact of different and discrete online activities. How does that not make it into that 2020 paper, that line? You're completely misrepresenting what these guys have said. You know, we need to look at loads of stuff. There is one point that the paper does say that says maybe the link is tenuous, but it's about how many friends you've
got. So basically, we seem to have academics denying any kind of link between social media and mental health
outcomes.
Yes, but what
and
we also
they're using papers to bolster that they're completely misrepresenting.
Yeah, I mean, this is just confirmation bias at its finest, because if you look at things that Facebook is publishing itself, along with other academics, you have a paper in the proceeding of the National Academy of Sciences, and they're showing emotional contagion effects. So emotional contagion, obviously, is just the phenomenon of having one person's emotions and their behaviors directly trigger similar emotions and behaviors in other people.
I have a little description
that you
of
read.
That.
You don't even need nonverbal cues.
Exactly. Yeah. Peer socialization modifies your behavior. So the more socialized within a group you are, the more likely you are to behave to the norms of that social group. There's definite, like, you know, all your mates smoke weed, you're going to smoke weed. You know, your family's religious, you're probably going to be religious.
The really interesting thing about this is, in this study, they ran a study on, forget 19,000 people in a meta-analysis. Facebook ran a massive study on nearly 700,000 users. And they manipulated the newsfeed content. So they displayed positive or negative emotional content. And then they analyzed whether this impacted the sort of statuses that they wrote, whether they were then positive or negative. And the results simply showed that users would exhibit more positive or negative emotions depending on the type of content they were shown.
So if people saw more positive content, they would
post more positive statuses, and the same in the other direction. So you could make people very negative and depressed and anxious, or you could make people very happy, joyful, depending on the emotions that you were showing them.
What's crazy about that is that it's not just how you're making them feel, is how you're making them type.
Yeah, you're changing their behavior.
That's what it is. It's, you're not just making them feel a certain thing. I'm sitting here and feeling sad. Like, no, I'm going to engage in a certain way. I'm going to put fingers to keypad or, you know, to mouse button.
They
did
a similar published study where they showed that they could influence people's ability or influence how many people went out to vote during the election. So they could do that without triggering conscious awareness. So Facebook has shown that it can manipulate your newsfeed such that it can change your behavior in the real world. And the interesting thing about the first study that I was describing is that they showed that you don't need any interaction with your friends or any nonverbal cues. Simply looking at the newsfeed and looking at emotional content was enough to make you emotionally contagious. So it doesn't have to be, like you say, like if your family's religious, you're more likely to be, you know, shared football teams, friendship groups. You don't even need friends. You can be totally isolated. They can isolate you and just show you certain content, and they can still make you take on those emotions.
From the horse's mouth.
Right, precisely.
From the horse's mouth.
Exactly.
You see, this is what's concerning. I don't know that it's concerning that, you know, the guys who did that 2020 paper didn't do enough reading or were just lazy as hell, or whether the journals just needed to publish something that month, or whether this is just this is like some kind of agenda or blanket denial, maybe because you're computational psychologists, or maybe it's because I don't know what your intentions are, but I worry that research that is coming out in 2020 and stuff that's in the pipeline is going to get published, even with this documentary, even with research going back 6 years, 7 years.
See, there is a strange effect. When I published, so basically I put my last status up on Facebook, and it was one where I was just letting people know I was going to delete my account, mm-hmm. and I was going to be reaching out to certain, you know, particular people I wanted to stay in touch with. But, you know, so people knew not to try and find me on Facebook Messenger. And I got really mixed feedback from people. And I wonder if it's the same sort of thing with the researchers. Well, I say mixed feedback. Actually, I didn't get mixed feedback. Everybody was defensive.
Hmm.
And I said it wasn't about individual responsibility, because we all have supercomputers aimed at our brains.
It's not about you.
Trying to addict us. Yeah. No, it's about the systemic effects of this.
Exactly.
But everyone was really defensive, and everyone was telling me I had this binary false choice between living in a hut and being Henry Thoreau, or being being on the platform. Being a user, like a fucking drug addict.
Yeah.
Like, which is, I quite like that. The only industries that get to call their customers users are social media and the drug trade.
Yeah.
But I got this really sort of negative feedback from people. And I wonder if it's the same thing with researchers, you know, because when you're in it, it's a bit like telling a load of heroin addicts who are not self-aware to go and write a paper on the negative effects of heroin use.
Mm.
I mean, the problem with heroin use is most of them actually probably do realize. But let's say there's something, you know, fairly bad for you. And you're telling those people, because the problem is, it's something that you get addicted to, but it also makes you feel better in the moment while you're using it. It's a bit like these studies. One of the problems is that if you ask people whether they're anxious over fucking 8 years,
right,
they'll probably feel fine.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you take social media away from them. It's a bit like an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
They won't get the shakes until the alcohol stops.
Mm-hmm. And you've also got to think about the actual people you're asking. You're talking about adolescents, right?
Mm.
They're getting these shots of dopamine. Probably they do feel good. Yeah. They probably don't feel bad.
No, they probably
don't. You know, the way you're phrasing that question in the depression thing, it's like, well, you know, do you feel bad? Well, no. And they wouldn't be lying, because they're getting a shot of dopamine.
They don't feel bad.
They don't feel bad.
As long as they're in it and their behavior's being changed and they're being manipulated, right, they're addicted to it, they feel good.
And let's say as well that they're savvy. Let's say that they're not so retarded and just like drones, right? And they actually think that their parents have some control over them. But there's a psychologist in the house talking about the phone. What's going to happen to that phone if they're honest? Even if they were feeling bad, you know what I mean? They're never going to say that because they like the phone. They're getting their little hit. They're still addicted to this stuff. Don't take away my toy. It's so important to me.
Yeah.
And I see that with adults.
Yeah.
It's really crazy. And it's kind of, it's going to the root of development, like adolescent development.
Yeah.
And that's what my problem is. It's taking up a massive chunk of time of adolescent development that would have previously been spent, like, I'm not just going to say something twee, like in nature, hugging trees. You know, it would have been like maybe outside on the street corner, right?
Yeah.
For being crazy. But that's a better place for your kid to be than sat on the couch on their iPhone.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is one of the problems, because as soon as you articulate this kind of argument, people think that you're some kind of technophobe.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that was a lot of the response that I got. You're a technophobe. You can't just disengage with these platforms. You have to engage. You can't just be... And the problem is, I'm something of a technophile. I work in technology. I'm constantly trying to dish out AI to people, trying to give people technologies that will enable them to do their jobs better. The modern workplace, etc., etc. Technology is fantastic. Technology helps us do all sorts of fantastic, wonderful things. But the wrong technology, the wrong technology can really negatively affect your day. Why am I not giving social media tools to people? Why am I not giving people addictive tools at work? Well, because we don't want people addicted to social media at work.
Mm.
Like, and why do we not give people...
Why doesn't people have like 6 cans of lager on the desk when they rock up?
Precisely. And it comes down to a fundamental difference in the business model. Who's paying for it? You know, at work, we pay for tools that serve us and we give them to the employees.
No one gives you a hammer for free. No. You buy a hammer.
Exactly.
And then it waits there for you to pick it up and use it.
Well, there's a lovely quote that's, if you're not paying for the product, then you are the product.
Yeah, that's so good.
And, I mean, that has its roots in TV because it's fairly similar. But if you're not paying for it, you are the product. And social media companies are simply competing for your attention. The problem is nested in the business model. They're reselling your attention, a bit like newspapers. I think it was the New York Sun was the first newspaper ever to run adverts. And they managed to undercut the competition in terms of the cost of the paper, the price of the paper. Because they funded it with adverts.
Right, okay. They were subsidized.
Yeah,
it's subsidized.
Business model innovation.
And people preferred the lower price of the paper.
Of course, of course. And what they essentially found was a way to resell.
That's not inherently wrong. That's not inherently wrong in itself.
No, not in and of itself.
It's just when the content of your paper starts changing.
Yeah, and it would naturally. I mean, it would naturally. If you want to keep advertisers on board, then of course it will. But, I mean, at least with things like newspapers, that I mean, the newspaper, radio, TV argument, just being an older version of what we have now, is fundamentally flawed. And we'll go into that. But ultimately, social media companies, like everything that's gone before, are trying to resell your attention. They're trying to work out how to keep you on that platform and sustain your attention for as long as they possibly can. And there's two definitions of the product of social media that I quite like. One is by Jaron Lanier, who he's the father of virtual reality. He's a computer scientist.
I love that guy. He's so cool.
He's so cool.
Mm. Yeah, he's just so cool. Sorry, carry on. Yeah, he is just a cool guy.
Yeah,
you're like those of you who watch the documentary, you'll see him, and he is cool. You'll like him. I did. I loved him. Yeah.
Yeah, but he's very articulate. And one of the things he said is, he said the product is the gradual, slight, imperceptible change in your own behavior and perception. That is the product. He said, "There's no other product. Nothing else."
The gradual, slight, imperceptible change in your own behavior
and perception. Yeah. And the other product definition was by Shoshana Zuboff, who's a Harvard professor, and she wrote this book, The Age of Surveillance Capitalism. And she says, social media sells certainty to advertisers. I'm paraphrasing. Certainty that when they place an ad, it'll be effective. And in order to be successful in that industry, you have to have great predictions. And great predictions require great data. And that's surveillance capitalism. They have to collect more and more data to make better and better predictions about you and what you will do and what you are receptive to.
Mm.
So they're selling certainty to advertisers.
Mm.
That's the product.
You see, this could even... So say we take that this 2020 study that I've been rinsing into in good faith. Say we take it in good faith, right? It could be that it's in their best interest to keep you not depressed.
Yeah.
You know, so in a way, if you were looking for depression, you wouldn't find it because they're not trying to make you depressed. You know, you might not even realize you are. This is the whole point.
Yeah.
It's you're behaving in such a way that you don't even know. You can't even see that this is an unnatural way to be spending your time, to be focusing your eyes on.
Yeah, they're trying to make you anxious and bored when you're not using the platform.
Yeah.
Right? So if you are using the platform, you won't feel anxious and you won't feel bored.
Continual dissatisfaction with just mundane yourself.
Yeah.
You know, just sitting with yourself is wrong. This is a bad thing. Actually, you need to be looking at something, doing something, interacting.
You can be bored and the anxiety will drive you back to the platform. Perfect. Because that's where they need you, because they're selling you ads.
Exactly.
And actually, this Shoshana Zuboff also then says, and I love this, she says, there's a marketplace now for human futures. Like you have oil futures and pork belly futures. You are now trading on the future state of humans.
Hmm.
And that's what they're selling to advertisers. And there's three primary goals. It's engagement, it's growth, and it's advertising. They're trying to drive up use. They're trying to keep users scrolling all the time. The more engagement, the better. They're trying to grow the platform, so they're trying to get you to invite more and more friends onto the platform, and they're trying to maximize the revenue through adverts.
Hmm.
So the longer you stay on that device, the more they can drive up ad revenue. And the more people on the platform, the better. And this is the problem, because people always say, well, you know, what if I am swayed one way or the other for Nike trainers versus Adidas trainers? You know, what does it really matter?
Hmm.
And we can take out the whole election hacking stuff. We can take out all the really negative consequences for one moment, all the really obvious stuff that you see in the news. And you can say, but Nike versus Adidas trainers, simple billboard style advertising. Well, it's always been around. What's wrong with it? Well, the difference is, to get your attention, to sell you these adverts, to make that money, they have to have you on the platform. And so the platform is designed to be addictive.
To keep you on
it. To keep you on it. So the real tyranny is not in showing you different adverts that are
better or worse targeting. It's not Adidas just taking a nice picture of somebody wearing some trainers as part of their marketing
campaign.
Yeah,
that's fine. That's fine. It's the fact that they need the billboard to constantly be in front of your eyes. The many billboards that are being paid for by these many companies. And so the platform is designed to be addictive. When your phone is off, it's going to push you notifications that, I don't know if you've noticed, seem more and more mundane and irrelevant. You know, so-and-so has just posted a new status. Well, I never asked to get updates about, you know, my cousin posting a status.
You know what's crazy? The less and less I used Facebook, it was like showing me birthdays of people that I just like, I've never sent them a single message.
No, and you start getting more and more emails as well about things that are totally irrelevant.
But then, you know, if you've got people on your Facebook, you've never sent a single message, and that's like three quarters of your Facebook, why the fuck are you on there, man? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
You're surrounded by people that you're never going to message, you're never going to talk to.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a friendship group that can be, like, truly relied upon in a way. And this is one of the points of it hijacking in adolescence, the formation of solid friendship groups. And that's this, like, really important. I've got a good quote here from Brown and Larson and Wood, Bukowski and Liz, who quote them here, saying that, like, positive adjustment during adolescence. So, like, you know, become insecure in who you're becoming, you know, become insecure in your friendship groups, you know, because it's a tumultuous emotional time. It says here that that's influenced by the possession of broad skills and social acceptance one acquires. So things like status and power within friendship groups that you get. And these findings highlight the importance of social circles and the opportunities for learning and positive friendship provisions that are experienced at different periods during development. The quality of friendships and security of them is just massively important. And it offsets stuff like depression, anxiety in adolescence. Why is there a massive epidemic of depression and anxiety in adolescence despite some people saying that there's absolutely nothing? The only thing that pops up in the time frame is social media, is screens, is devices. It's what Jonathan Haidt and Gene Twenge say. It's like, look, these things are happening. 100% increase. It's like, look, people might argue that going from 10 suicides in pre-adolescent girls to 15 suicides in pre-adolescent girls is negligible. Some people might argue that, right? And say that actually, you know, despite that being 135% increase or whatever it represents, that's not actually important.
50% increase.
50% increase or whatever. It's just like, well, those weren't the... I think there was more than 100% increase in suicide in pre-adolescent girls.
There's been a huge uptick
since such and such a time. But critics of this position say, well, it's only like 30 girls out of 100,000.
It's very callous.
And it's like, well, it's not only is it callous, it's like, well... it's short-sighted. If you're talking about 100-odd% in a short period of time, and if you look, say, that usership is rising 100% every single year, then what gives you any reason to think that that's going to stop?
And also, there are other things happening. It's not just suicides. There's stages before people actually take that step. You know, people become depressed and anxious, and there's an increase in that as well. There's more and more people becoming depressed and anxious.
This is exactly it, and it speaks again to what you were talking about, social contagion. And if we are to get more specific, because people, you know, time spent obviously isn't enough, we need to get more specific. 6 years ago, the same year that Facebook released the PNAS proceedings that you just mentioned.
Yeah.
There was a study on self-esteem. Mm. Now, granted, we're using questionnaire data again. It was designed to see if students who had greater exposure to upward comparisons via social media, so, you know, they're looking at people who are healthier, more successful, got a better-looking girlfriend, whatever, any of that, and how does that affect self-esteem. And then they did another study as well, which was more about the temporary nature, just glancing at various profiles, in which they created a bunch of fictional profiles profiles which put the social projection upwards and downwards, and then got you very quickly afterwards to say, like, kind of how it made you feel. And on both things, self-esteem was worse, just flat out worse. Mm. It says, like, the results revealed that participants' state self-esteem, so the self-esteem that they were in at that moment, and relative self-evaluations were lower than the target person's profile contained in upward comparison information. So every time they saw somebody with a higher upward social comparison compared to themselves, they'd always rate themselves as lower.
So no matter who you're looking
equal
at,
to them.
No matter who you're looking at, people who have in very basic, crude language, a better life than you or a worse life than you, from the way you evaluate that, you're still going to feel shit.
This is it, and it's all made up anyway. You're looking at people's made up fake great lives.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's filtered. It's filtered for the best moments, and they're not even the best moments. They are just, I mean, photographers have known this. I mean, I don't have to lecture you about film and photography, but everything is within a frame. I mean, you can look at a photo that's beautiful or a frame in a film, but outside of those four edges, there's a lot of information. There's a lot of information that's not being seen. So you can capture it down. I mean, I went to some, when I was in Crete, I went to this beach that didn't look up to much at one end of it, but you could still frame a photo that was beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, God forbid, I could have spent the entire time on my phone if I wanted to and not interacted with anyone around me, not enjoyed myself, not being in the moment. I could have taken that beautiful picture on this really tardy looking beach and people would have thought I'm having this great time. That's not reality.
Mm. I asked one of my colleagues what was her biggest fear with social media. She works with young people.
Mm.
She said it's this having to feel like life is great all the time really worries her.
Mm-hmm.
And that kids are growing up thinking everything's great, everything should be great. If things aren't great, then there's something wrong.
Yeah.
If I need to look perfect, I need to look like these weird filters, and this concerned her. And I was like, you know, coming from a teacher, I wonder how many teachers actually worry about that. I bet it's loads, man. I bet it's loads.
Yeah, of course.
They're just so concerned about that. You know, like kids arrive at school just tired because they've been up all night looking at pings on the phone.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's a terrible state of affairs. You know, you wouldn't, if a kid showed up to school stinking of booze, you'd raise welfare concerns.
Yeah, and this is one of the big key differences between social media companies and, in this example, alcohol companies.
Mm-hmm.
An alcohol company does not know who's addicted to their product. They don't know. They distribute to...
Exactly. It takes for granted that a big part of their business is off ones who drink loads, like freemium gaming or whatever. Yeah. And then there's the rest of the general population who drink normally.
But they don't know. You can't regulate alcohol companies.
Yeah, they don't know it's you on the street.
Exactly. You can't tell an alcohol company to get down their addiction levels. Maybe they can put money into funding, like, you know, campaigns and support mental health
charity
support
and organization,
but that's practically all they can do. They don't have any individual level data. Social media companies, they do know who's addicted because they have that data. They can see when someone's been up until 2 a.m. on the platform. They can see who's compulsively checking their feed 100 times a day. They can see all of this data. They can tell, I mean, they say that after 300 likes, they can tell more about your big five personality traits. So that's your extroversion, openness, your conscientiousness, your agreeableness, and your neuroticism. They can tell more about that than your spouse after 300 likes. They have so much data on us. They know who's addicted. And that's fundamentally the difference. You could regulate them and have an agency that says, okay, look, you need to give me the data on however many of these people fit this definition of addiction, and you now have a regulated target to get that down. Otherwise, we'll fine you. Otherwise, we'll close you the fuck down.
Mm.
Like, you could do that. Mm. And social media can see that. It's very different to alcohol industry. It's very different to many other industries.
What's crazy is you might have two apps on your phone. One's Facebook that wakes you up at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
And the other's an app that's trying to get you to go to sleep at a normal time.
Yeah, you've got Calm next to Facebook.
You've got Calm right next to Facebook, you know? If our devices were really made to help us, then it would say... There would be an algorithm that says you've been spending too much time on your phone, and it shut itself off after 10 o'clock every night because you weren't getting enough sleep.
Yeah.
And you'd just be unable to use it.
Absolutely. And but you can do that with certain apps now.
Right, but you have to do that.
Yeah, and that these are some of the mechanisms you have to put in place. You have to put hard... I think we have to put friction between us and technology.
Mm.
That's what needs to come... In the future, we need more friction. I mean, even simple examples like Monzo, for example, they found the sign-up process. So Monzo, for anyone who's not in the UK, is a UK challenger bank. It's a digital bank.
Like a Revolut, like a card. It's like an online card system.
Yeah, it's an online bank. It's a digital bank account, no physical branches. But they found that the sign-up process was too fast. So they put friction back into it. They put a spinning circle in there. So they put a fake loading screen in there just to create more friction. because they wanted people to understand what they were doing. They understand the impact of signing up. There's other examples, like some terms and conditions now, they will flag you up. When you scroll to the bottom really, really quickly, it'll flag up and it'll say, look, you know, there's no way you've read this in the, you know, in the last 2 seconds. So, you know, just understand what you are signing up for. Just lets you, it gives you a prompt, and it's putting friction back in between the user and the technology. Whereas things like Facebook at the moment, they're trying to become frictionless, because a bit like in a casino, there's no right angles in a casino.
Well, it's how quickly can we sign you up?
Well, it's how quickly, but then also in a casino, there's no right angles, or they try not to have any right angles when you're following the carpets, because they don't. A right angle invites a choice. It invites a decision, and they don't want anyone making decisions or having any conscious awareness
of this. So there's just like rings of carpet.
The rings of carpet. It's a bit like IKEA, just rings. They want people guided through. They want no conscious decision making to take place. They just want you to be compliant. And in a flow state, there's a lot of research that shows this flow state that we talk about with artists and all these things.
Marathon runners.
Well, also this flow state can take place with people that are scrolling through social media. It's not necessarily a good thing. It just basically means that time becomes a mere concept and you get sucked into this.
Well, it's like the guy who works at Facebook says about it, isn't it? It's the same brain that you have. Head of growth at Facebook. He said something that, you know, you've only got one brain. Whether it's the brain, you're training it in one way. You know what I mean? So whether you're training it to be a long endurance marathon runner, it's the same brain you're training. It's that same habit thing. So you're either training your habit senses in the center of your brain to be a smoker, or you're training it to be working out and eating healthy every day. It's the same one. You've not got multiple versions of this. So it's really, but social media is programmed to hijack that brain.
Yeah.
That thing that you could be using to do that business, to create that technology, to learn that skill, to do that thing, is being taken up by this device in your hand.
Yeah.
That's really important to learn. There is no time extra after you put that phone down.
No.
That's it.
And actually, I mean, if you think about James Clear with Atomic Habits, he says that there's many decisive moments in your day. And one of those decisive moments for me, for example, is when I wake up.
Right.
There's a decisive moment. There's many decisions I can make later on, but this is a clear decision that's going to have a disproportionate impact. Mm-hmm. Do I get straight up when I wake up? My alarm goes off. Do I get up or do I not? Now, that decisive moment in your day can be hijacked by social media. Mm-hmm. How many times do people, and I already know the answer because people talk about this very openly. When people wake up, they tend to go on their phone. They tend to open up social media. They tend to refresh the last thing they were looking at the night before. But that's a decisive moment where your day can be totally changed. And so now, since I've basically moved back to the UK and I've had an opportunity to craft my habits around a new environment, that decisive moment now is totally taken up by me just getting up and making a coffee.
Yeah.
And it's totally changed. Well, it's changed my life. I mean, it wouldn't be an overstatement. It's changed my life. Mm. I did it before, and I lost 15 kilos. And that was a similar thing. Jocko Willink, I was getting up at 4:30 every morning. That was a bit extreme. that was a bit much. But like,
this photo of your watch every morning.
Every like, morning, yeah.
Jocko.
Exactly. But like, these are decisive moments that social media is hijacking. And actually, just to put a finer point on it, in terms of the social harm this is doing, again, Jaron Lanier, the founder of VR, he has this fantastic quote, and this really for me encapsulates the problem. He says, "We've created a world in which online connection becomes primary, especially for younger generations. Yet in that world, any time two people connect, the only way it's financed is through a sneaky third person who is paying to manipulate those two people. So we've created an entire global generation of people who are raised within a context where the very meaning of communication, the very meaning of culture, is manipulation. We've put deceit and sneakiness at the absolute center of everything we do." That for me is very, very clear. And he then puts a finer point on it, and this is all in that Social Dilemma documentary. He says, "You can understand how wrong a newsfeed being manipulated is if you think for a moment of Wikipedia. Imagine Wikipedia allowed a different version of the page to be displayed depending on some commercial interest. So every time you open it up, it's going to show you something different. Depending
a different
on
version
what
of British history based because, you know, Coke wants to sell something." Or,
yeah, exactly. Or you open up the Pepsi page and Coke is, you know, it's incredibly wrong. I mean, everyone would be very, very, it's very, very clear that.
It's like facts changing, are up for sale.
Yeah, facts are up for sale. Exactly. Precisely that. And we can see that that's wrong. So given that most people consume their news content through a social media feed now.
Yeah.
why would it be any different? Why should it not be like Wikipedia? We are all seeing our own curated news feed around the individual, around us. So we all have our own Truman Show going on. Even two people, it's been shown in studies that two people who are very, very similar, very close friends, will have vastly different news feeds.
You're living in your own made-up Truman Show.
Exactly.
And in a way, the Truman Show is worse than the Matrix, because the Matrix is just using your energy. It wasn't dragging you one way or another, manipulating your behavior. You were free within the Matrix.
You were happy in the Matrix.
Yeah, it just needed your power. You know, it just needed your electricity, your body heat. You know? It's crazy. It's like we're in this situation that's like both 1984 and Brave New World.
1984, surveillance.
So you've got Brave Big New Brother, world, the surveillance, drugged. But then you've also got your soma, your dope, your hit up, you know. It's exactly like
to make
Lanier
you stop
says.
Feeling negative emotions.
That's it.
You take
feeling
your
nothing.
Soma, you take your drugs. One of the big pushbacks that I got was, well, we'll learn to live with it. It'll be the same as every other time. There was TV, there was radio, there was newsprint. It's always been the same. And it's just a more high-tech version of what's come before. But it's all advertising. You never paid for a TV channel. You never paid for the, you know, radio. You paid for the set to receive it, but that was it. So just one investment. I mean, that's wrong, because it's fundamentally different. Because the technology now is exponentially improving. I mean, since the 1960s, processors have got a trillion times faster. A car has gone twice as fast.
Yeah.
None of the previous mediums could collect data on viewers, let alone on individuals. They just kind of did surveys in certain areas and tried to get their best sort of demographic prediction. But they couldn't make predictions on individuals. And then also, it's so pervasive. You didn't take your TV out to the park with you. You didn't take TV outside, or you didn't wake up in the morning and immediately watch it, and that's the last thing you do before you go to bed. And then at every other point during the day, you can possibly check in the TV 100 times a day. That's not what was happening. And they have the ability to put those three things together. You've got a supercomputer pointed at your brain that is collecting data on you, nobody else, on you. So you're already trying to outcompete a supercomputer with your prehistoric wetware brain. Yeah. It's got data on you that you're not even aware of, that Facebook has already shown can trigger your behavior subconsciously.
Yeah.
And it's with you all day long. It's with you all day long and in ever more pervasive ways.
And you'll never turn it off. And you don't want to turn it off.
Because
and when
addictive.
Someone tells you you should turn it off, you're like, no, I don't need to turn it off. There's no problem here. I'm different.
No, and just to quickly run through some of, I mean, let's just think about how many different things this can impact. I mean, your ability to make sense of the world, for example. You know, misinformation.
What is reality?
What
itself.
Is reality? This is really, really important, because if we cannot agree on what reality is, we cannot move forward as a society. And look, you know, misinformation. Hold on. I just want to pour this wine.
You're doing a very good job there.
Yeah, yeah.
A nice good angle.
Yeah, there we go. Perfect. Misinformation. I mean, if we can't agree on what's true, how can we move forward as a society? Because everyone says, well, one of the positives of social media is it brings us together and we can solve societal problems. Yeah, that's all very well until people use the platform to make people to divide people and to set up, for example, activist events that are opposing across the street from each other. I mean, this is what's happening. And so, for example, 64% of all extremist group joins are due to the recommendation tools on Facebook. It's mad. You know, fake news spreads six times faster on social media than true news.
You know what? That's a great statistical representation of a turn of phrase. You know, there's a turn of phrase that says, like, a lie's got up, gone round the world twice before the truth had its breakfast.
Right, exactly. And it's a bit like, if it bleeds, it leads. People actually, they attend to these things more, which is why people share it more.
Because it's salient in you. You're more likely to engage with something that you disagree with.
Yeah.
If something is pleasant, then you really don't notice it. It's like you don't notice the compliment someone might pay you that day.
No.
But you'll notice a slight, or you'll notice someone cuts you off when you're on your bike.
And it makes sense evolutionarily. We have a negativity bias. So there's one phrase that Daniel Kahneman uses, which I quite like. He says, one cockroach can ruin a bowl of cherries.
Yeah.
Right? But one cherry doesn't make a bowl of cockroaches any more appealing. And it's obvious, as we were evolving as a species, the negative things were much more important. Mm. You know, these are threats. These are things in the bushes that are going to eat us.
That's why we have disgust receptors.
Yeah.
It's why that's so
ingrained
in us. So
we don't get poisoned from berries we've foraged. You know, novelty is a bad thing evolutionarily. If it's new, it's bad. And we need to attend to things that are bad much more than we do things that are good. If things are good, whatever. Well, we'll continue as a species.
It's like no news is good news.
Right, precisely. And good news, well, that's nice.
Yeah, but whatever.
Whatever. We don't need to attend to that. We'll just enjoy it while it's here. And so, yeah, of course. And anger proliferates through social media much, much faster as an emotion than any other emotion. I mean, that's been shown really clearly, and that was the emotional contagion study that Facebook published. You know, and one really clear thing is just one exposure to a fake news item increases the chances of believing it on the next encounter. And this is, in psychology, the illusory truth effect. It's just this tendency to believe false information to be correct after repeated exposure.
You can do that. They know that from eyewitness testimony.
Yes, that's exactly the
stuff
field.
From the 70s.
Exactly.
You know?
But I mean, one of the things here is you always think, well, if I know better, that's fine. But no, because knowledge doesn't protect against the illusory truth effect.
Yeah,
this
that's
is
right.
Crazy thing.
That's like saying, I can't get hypnotized.
Yeah.
Well, actually, maybe you can. Did you ever watch Derren Brown when he gets that guy to shoot Stephen Fry?
Oh, I haven't seen that one.
So class. It's brilliant. It was all based on the Lee Harvey Oswald, like... No, it wasn't Lee Harvey Oswald, but there was a guy who shot someone, and he said that he didn't even know there was a woman in a spotted dress that he'd never met before, and he had no memory of anything. He didn't even use guns, this guy, back in, like, the 70s, and he's in life in prison or whatever.
Oh, wow.
But he shot some guy, and he had, like, no shooting experience or anything. Like, Derren Brown was there to prove that you could just take anybody, train them... to use a gun,
yeah.
Have them forget and just trigger them to just do something.
Yeah.
And this is without a smartphone.
Precisely.
Or the most powerful computational power that the world has ever seen.
Exactly.
Algorithms so insanely complicated that not even the creators know what's going on with them. They're just going on. It's like, you know, you talk about Skynet, we talk about Terminator 2. It's like, that's not the future. We've already lost control of this thing.
Yeah. 45% of tweets about COVID-19 have been from misinformation bots. And people are reposting on the basis of a message's popularity rather than its accuracy. So as long as you have enough bots to spread a message as far as, you know, to quickly and pervasively, then you can actually change the discourse. And what you see now, a lot of the Russian election hacking is about trying to get journalists to retweet it. Because as long as you can get one journalist to cover it in the mainstream news, it gives a certain amount of credibility to the story. And now it's truth. And Renee Diresta talks about, she has this phrase where she says, if you can make it trend, you can make it true. Because that's how that system works. And people are sharing things. I mean, Facebook very quickly realized, and this is what you see now, Facebook changed. At some point, Facebook turned around and says, well, we've tried to make things better now. We've tried to make it so you see much more content from your family and friends and people you care to hear from.
Right.
And they tried to dress this up as like a really, you know, it's a good step forward. But it turns out that you're much more likely to believe content shared by people you want to be affiliated with. So friends, family, and celebrities that you want to follow. So again, it's just more behavior change. I mean, there's so many of these. But I mean, we cannot agree on what's true.
We need to be able to talk about various problems. If we can't even, if the people who create systems specifically to screw with people's behavior, to make them do things for corporate interests or for whatever interest is paying for it, and you still deny that is true. This is, you have to accept like that. You might be a victim here.
So, I mean, let's just think about some psychological indicators at the moment, like attention and cognition. I mean, these are all things that you can find on the Ledger of Harms for the Center of Humane Technology. They go through all of this. So a lot of what's come up in this podcast has been from them. They've collated a lot of this.
It's a really important website to go and visit.
Very important.
I have signed up. I know it sounds weird, seeing as we've been talking about getting off kind of stuff, but I feel that the intention with these guys is very... good. They want to do good. They don't want to take the smartphone out of your hand.
No.
They want to make it useful to you, far more useful to you.
Exactly. They have ethical design principles that they believe should be baked into technologists' future technologies, but they just want these technologies to help society as opposed to downgrading it.
Sure.
But think about attention and cognition. So 75% of screen content is viewed for less than 1 minute. You know, most people switch between different content every 19 seconds.
That's what a lot of our conversations were when I was working with the startup, especially with kickstarting projects or like crowdfunding projects. It's about how do you make like your content, if you're trying to extract money out of somebody to crowdfund your project, how do you make it interesting to look at for more than 60 seconds? Then it just proportionally got less and less and less and less because content expands. The more content there is out there, the less time people are going to look at anything.
Yeah.
And they've got literal timers that time how much you look at images.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. As you scroll through your newsfeed, they can see exactly how long you're looking at things. People sometimes say, well, I don't engage anymore. I don't comment, I don't
that
like.
That doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter, because they can see how long you're looking at things. If you pause over something and read it...
You're on there 30 seconds, you're engaged. You don't need to click nothing.
Yeah, you don't have to click anything. And they're going to serve up more of the things that you look at for longer and less of the things that you don't. You don't have to engage anymore. You can just be a voyeur, and they will analyze you. But yeah, I mean, and one of the things I really appreciate about you, Andy, is, so this next statistic is draining attention. Because the mere presence of your phone, even when it's turned off and face down, drains your attention. So there's this study of several hundred adults showing that their working memory and their ability to solve new problems were just like significantly reduced when their phones were turned off but present on their desks as opposed to being in another room. So when you came to mine recently, I realized you left your phone in the living room. We were outside in the garden.
Yeah.
Right, it's about not having your phone present. It's one thing that it's something that I'm particularly anal about. It's not having my phone on the table. Everyone puts their phone on the table, and then right, it vibrates, and they attend to it. Even if it's face down, it vibrates. They know about it, and if it's not vibrating, they'll check it every so often.
Yeah,
because it's a high priority stimulus that's just sitting there.
Well, and that's the thing. I leave it in the other room because it does my head in if someone's looking at the phone when they're talking to you.
Yeah, same. And it indicates to the other person.
I demand your attention.
Well, precisely. But it indicates to the other person that you are not actually present with them.
Right, yeah.
And it's really damaging. It's really, really damaging. I mean, there is another statistic, which is it's about social relationships. Because we all think, well, you know, we're so much more connected and present with people. Basically, the mere presence of a mobile phone can disrupt the connection between two people, leading to these reduced feelings of empathy, trust, and a sense of closeness. So when you ask pairs of strangers to have a meaningful conversation, their ability to connect emotionally was significantly reduced if a mobile phone was visible. I mean, it's not good to have around.
It's between us.
Exactly.
Because
it's demanding your attention. That's what it is. It's attention extraction. That's what it needs.
I often think about, you know, people my age, like I'm 34, right? Mm. And like, if you're listening now, like, I just want to ask you this question. Like, you know, if you're my age, if you were born in 1986,
yeah,
or before, or even just a little bit after, you know what life was like before a smartphone. You lived for 20 years in a world without Facebook, and you did it fine. You did it just fine. Yeah, there were problems. Yeah, you had issues. Yeah, you might not have known every single bit of news on planet Earth, right? But you got on just fine. I guess you either had friends or didn't have friends, you know, but life existed and you did just fine. And if you have kids, your kids are different if you elect to give them a phone. You have decided to give them about at least 50% of a different childhood than yours. You just have no access to that world. You won't know how to help them when things go wrong. And if you're thinking about that while you're staring at your own phone, you know, if you've given your kid a phone because you have a phone and you're fine, it's like, I want you to think how much time you spend sat on the couch staring at it.
Yeah, and I mean, here's a harrowing statistic exactly on that point. Parental use of mobile devices when they're playing with their kids can lead to these significant levels of child distress. So there was this study of 50 infant mother pairs, and it indicated that infants showed greater unhappiness and fewer positive emotions and were significantly less likely to play with toys when their mothers just simply looked at their devices for as little as 2 minutes. 2 minutes. So, I mean, just think about that. If you've got kids and you have a phone, you're I don't want to put the pressure on the individual here because you have a supercomputer pointed at your brain trying to extract your attention. But there are things we'll talk about that you can put in place to prevent this to some degree. If you are checking your phone, you are very likely going to be increasing the levels of child distress. That's not your fault, but you should be fucking angry with the social media companies.
Yes, yes. Look, you can't stop a bullet coming at your head. You're not Neo from The Matrix. Yeah, you're not. Yeah. You know, and that bullet was designed with one specific purpose. You know what I mean? It's like it's strong and it's powerful and it's got a trajectory and it's backed up, you know, by physics.
Yeah.
And this is the same. It's like I really don't mean to sound like I'm shitting on anyone. It's like, no, I'm not. I'm like, look, this is It's a problem. You probably have a problem. I definitely had a problem.
So did I.
Definitely 100%. I cannot say that realistically that I'd spent, like, I didn't spend time on Facebook for years, that I didn't fall down into Facebook groups that influenced, like, my behaviors, like, what I thought about the world, my ideologies.
Yeah, exactly.
All of it. Like, Facebook has been stamped on my ideological decisions since I was about 23.
Yeah.
And that is crazy. I should have read more to form an ideology.
Yeah, precisely.
I should have done better. I should have been more vigilant. You know, so I'm not shitting on anybody, but this is true. This is not a conspiracy theory.
No,
they are doing this to you and to your kids.
Exactly. And I mean, if you want to think about the real, because people say, well, I can come off Facebook at any time. But like some people believe they can just give up cigarettes whenever.
Oh yeah, I'm one of them.
Right, exactly. But however, if think about addiction, right? This has physiological effects on your brain. And there are studies that show the greater your level of Facebook addiction, the lower your brain volume. So there's these MRI scans of Facebook users that demonstrate a significant reduction in gray matter in the amygdala, which is essentially the short circuit for like a fight or flight. It's basically the front door through which all things come in your brain. That's correlated with their level of addiction to Facebook, that reduction in gray matter. And the pruning away of this brain matter is really similar to the type of cell death you see in cocaine addicts. It's crazy, isn't it? It's crazy. That's what's happening to people that are addicted to Facebook.
It's like, would you rack up some lines for your 10-year-old?
Precisely. Because this is one of the problems. People say, well, if I don't give a phone to my kid, they're going to be maligned at school.
They're going to feel isolated. And they're going to feel all this stuff.
I get it. Like, what we're saying is society is essentially one in which when people get to adolescence, or actually when people get to fucking old enough to hold a phone, what you're essentially doing, the analogy is you're opening the liquor cabinet and you're saying, here, alcohol is not inherently bad. Social media is not inherently bad, but it's hellishly addictive. So you're opening the liquor cabinet and you're saying, feel free.
That's it.
But just think about this. 1 month away from Facebook leads to a significant improvement in emotional well-being. We saw this in some of the Twenge papers. This is, you know, that was a study of 1,600 American adults who only use Facebook up to an hour each day. Only an hour. I mean, think most people use it for more than an hour.
Hmm.
And deactivating their accounts led to a significant increase in emotional well-being, which included a reduction in loneliness, ironically, and an increase in happiness. So it makes you more connected to come off of social media.
I found a very similar paper. It could have been that exact same paper that found that even though, well, when they deactivated the Facebook account, they actually didn't do online stuff as much. Any kind of online activity, all general online activity just kind of petered off.
Yeah.
And they did more things like watch TV by themselves, you know, with their own mind, I guess, just sit in solitude or talk more with their family or see their friends more, do different kinds of activities. So just turning off Facebook got them offline more, which was good. It's a good thing, surely, especially considering the internet's just this homogenous zone now.
Yeah, and you have to have the personal conviction to say, look, I'm going to be the first mover here. Because one of the things that Facebook does is it throws things at you and you can respond to it. So you reactively like things. You might reactively start a conversation online with someone. When you get rid of social media, you have to proactively reach out to people.
Mm-hmm.
But having left Facebook in the way that I have, I'm now engaging with people much more than I ever have. And it very quickly lets you know who the people are that actually want to be in touch with you. And you start scheduling in time to see people. You start saying, okay, once I've seen you, let's schedule in a time in the future. Like, let's meet up in a couple of months.
Mm.
You know, let's meet up next month.
For people, I guess, like ourselves and like myself, who understand the world before social media, there is a place to go back to.
Right,
there is a reference point. Yes. But we're dealing with entire generations.
Generations
that have no idea about the world before that ever existed.
I was just on the cusp of that. And I just remember a time before. I remember a time where dial-up... I mean, when I was... So basically, I was training a number of employees. And one of them... So she had something on the phone. She'd phoned this number. And it was... it was some alien noise. She had no idea what it was. And it was a fax. She had phoned a fax number. And you get basically...
You get the sound up, don't you?
Like a modem. That's essentially... Yeah, a modem, exactly. It sounds pretty much identical to a dial-up connection. Exactly. Or a dial-up connection. And she was like, oh my God, what is this? So I listened to it and I said, that's just simply... it sounds like a dial-up connection. It's probably a fax. It's just a modem dial-up. And she was like, what do you mean dial-up? I said, well, you know, this is before broadband. She goes, broadband? Like, I was like, high-speed internet. She was like, do you mean before Wi-Fi? And I was like, well, no, not really. Not before Wi-Fi, before high-speed internet. Wi-Fi is wireless internet. Is very different. And she was like, before, oh, you mean when the people put the plugs in the holes, there's like an operator? And I was like, first of all, that's telecommunications. That's an operator, like, and that's a
turn
many
of
decades
19th
before.
Century.
Yeah, I was like, you're in totally the wrong...
There's a fuzzy black hole of history. You know what I mean? Like, there was 100 years where there was, you know, dinosaurs, coal, trains. All of it happened in this messy muddle of time before Wi-Fi.
Yeah, exactly, and even broadband has been lost to the dinosaur era. Like, broadband is some antiquated thing. So yeah, and it was like, wow, okay, you've never actually known anything before wireless internet. These are the people that are now entering the workplace, and it's quite surprising, quite shocking. And they've grown up with it through their critical developmental years. Mm. I mean, if you think about something as simple as eating disorders and what people are going through during their teenage years, think about Instagram. The more time you spend on Instagram, and there's peer-reviewed studies showing this, the more time you spend on Instagram, the more likely you are to suffer eating disorders, such as, I don't know if you've heard of this, but orthorexia nervosa. So not anorexia, but orthorexia. So essentially, it's a clinical condition where sufferers, they just obsess about ideal foods, so much so that they stop eating adequately, and they seriously endanger their health. So it's like, if I'm not going to eat the ideal diet, it's distinct from anorexia. Mm. But it's unique to Instagram. They found that this was a unique phenomenon. And what was happening is the algorithm was basically allowing the sufferers of this to become trapped in this echo chamber of ideal food images. Hmm. So you start engaging more with these
images.
So people
take their
food.
Perfect picture of their perfect pancake and their perfect...
Their protein pancake or their ideal dinner.
With their perfect bicep or their perfect like bikini
They've eaten
board.
Shit for 6 days. Yeah, on the seventh day, it's a perfectly nutritious meal. Right. And they take a picture of it and they put it on their account.
Next to the pool.
Yeah, exactly.
From 6 years ago.
And this is getting served up to people with orthorexia nervosa or people with undiagnosed orthorexia nervosa. And people get trapped in this. And this is a direct function of the recommendation algorithm
on
that
Instagram.
Is because you're attending to it. If you attend to it, if you pay attention to it, it's going to serve you up more of it. I mean, it's really, really sad. I mean, to come back to the social connections, 50% of Americans are reporting that their partner is often or sometimes distracted by their devices when they're trying to talk to them.
Mm-hmm.
So I have conversations with men, and I reckon you probably have this experience. I don't know. But I have conversations. Well, I know damn well who you are because you'll psychoanalyze someone until they tell you their deepest, darkest inner secrets. You know exactly what I'm talking about. But like, I'll have conversations with men, and they will open up to me about something that's fairly just generally emotional. The sort of thing we might talk about. And they'll say, I've got plenty of friends, but I don't talk to any of them the way I talk to you. Mm. Now, I'm not special. All it is that I'm present with them and I'm willing to talk about things that are emotional. Now, generally, if you look at men, they don't talk about their emotions.
Mm.
And all you've now given them is another way to ignore it. You know, they've got a digital pacifier. They don't have to engage. They can just slip into that. And what it's doing is it's atrophying our ability to regulate our own emotions. Because as soon as we feel bad, as soon as we feel anxious, as soon as we feel depressed,
it comes out the pocket.
The digital pacifier comes out.
And it gives us our hit. And it makes us feel better.
Exactly. As soon as the conversation gets awkward, digital pacifier comes out. It's like having a FIFA with you at all times. It's like there's no real conversations that are happening between men. To put it hyperbolically. And
it's so true.
Different impression of this, but I know when I talk to men, somehow I'm always a therapist to them.
Mm.
And I know when I talk to women, because I've got probably more female friends than men, when I talk to women, they always talk about the guys that they know, become friends with or partner with. They suddenly realize they're being a therapist to men because men are not talking to each other.
You know what's so crazy? It's that for the longest time, men are absent, right? Fathers are absent.
Mm.
And they're absent because of work. They're absent because they're in the army. They're absent because they're down in mine. They're absent because, you know, they're the breadwinner because that's what society says.
Yeah.
And then time changes and the world changes and things, you know, we outsource all of those jobs to countries that we couldn't give a fuck about the population there. And we have them do it while we all become graphic designers. And the men in these societies and now have the opportunity to be more present than ever.
Yeah.
And they're not. They're absolutely not.
No.
Instead, they're stuck in these, You know, we've got paternity leave for like a year now. Like, guys can take like a year off to like raise their newborn baby. Like,
yeah.
God, 100 years ago, could guys do that? Like, absolutely not. You know what I mean? Like, you'd be lucky if the guy showed up at the birth.
Yeah.
We have this great opportunity to be more present than ever, but we're not. We're sticking our faces in phones. We're judging ourselves against completely fabricated realities that people are either making up or being given to make up. And it's a sad state of affairs. And the real issue is that kids now who are growing up post-smartphone, post-invention of social media, they just simply do not have the ability to go back to a time when it wasn't like that. What kids are growing up seeing is their parents with a face stuck in a phone or stuck in a tablet.
Yeah.
And then we get annoyed at them when they play too much Fortnite, when they're like staring too much at a tablet, when they're up all night looking at the phones. It's mm-hmm. like, it's terrible.
It's terrible. I mean, teen depression, after nearly two decades of it declining, depressive symptoms in teenagers have risen by 65%.
So much social contagion from social media that they're seeing. Their parents getting that same social contagion.
People are becoming more and more disconnected. Cyberbullying is rampant. And, you know, you're three times more likely to contemplate suicide compared to your peers if you're cyberbullied. Mm. And actually, the experience of being bullied online is so much worse because there's a bigger audience to it.
Mm.
It's actually shown to be worse than traditional bullying.
It never goes away. And you couldn't...
There's a permanent record of it.
And the thing is, somebody bullied you on a playground.
Mm.
There was always the opportunity to punch him in the face, to stand up for yourself.
Yeah, I had exactly this
in front of everybody.
Exactly, and I did exactly that. And I became friends with the guy.
Right,
because one day I put him on his back and he went, oh. And it was a weird moment where
you found out you had more in common than you didn't.
Very straight. It was like beautiful. One of these weird, weird stories.
Stand by me, you know what I mean?
But that was never going to happen online.
Never going to happen online. Never going to happen online. And the situation is never going to arise online where they're ever going to find a common ground. You're never going to have your opinion challenged.
People are going to listen to this and say, yeah, but aren't we missing one of the key benefits of social media, which is overriding oppression?
Right.
Like, look at the George Floyd things, look at Black Lives Matter.
Absolutely.
And it's like, yeah, fine, there are some positives. However, think about the internal training at Facebook. Facebook's internal training materials for its moderators say that they will allow praise, support, and representation of white separatism as an ideology. So as long as it doesn't berate anybody else, they'll allow it. And there's the sustained counter-information campaigns that are made viral by social media.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
So after George Floyd's killing, social
hashtag
media...
Hashtag shut down STEM, right. For example.
Exactly. And then, for example...
By the way, guys, if you've not heard of hashtag shut down STEM... Go and find it and just have a look at it and let us know what you think through our website.
But then there's like, you know, for example, Blacktivism and actually the Russian election hackers showed that they could stop people from going to the polls because they basically got into the identity politics of, okay, I'm a black person and therefore the system doesn't serve me. This may all be true, but then the problem then becomes they say, okay, we've now got into your ideology and now we're going to make you believe that this system doesn't serve you, therefore, don't vote.
Yeah, right.
And now we have Trump. And
what's more, they don't even have to hack them to do this.
No,
this is just a product.
They're not hacking. They're just using the platform.
They're just using the platform. Like,
precisely.
We use the platform.
This is the design of the platform. We used the platform in the past.
We've paid Facebook to advertise Abstract's podcast.
I can find lookalike groups. I can say, I want 100 people that look like this.
Right,
and
I
can target you. It can give me your ideological viewpoint. We put all the ideologies in there. We want left and right.
Yeah,
I was
like,
I don't want this left to an algorithm to decide for me. So I try to specify everything as broadly as possible. But some things, you want people that listen to these podcasts.
Sure.
We want lookalike groups. And it works. But, I mean, we're coming off of social media.
Yeah, totally.
You can only find us on our website and on the podcast.
We'll talk more about that later. We'll do a little aside thing for that.
But if you think that technology companies have your fucking best interests at mind and it's a left-wing enterprise in the Silicon Valley, think of TikTok, the Chinese conglomerate, or the Chinese company, rather. They've got over 800 million users, and it promotes itself as this place of self-expression. But they've got moderators. So they've got this policy for the moderators where they'll downgrade content from users who don't fit normative ideals of gender, race, class, sexuality, or able-bodiedness. So the moderators are urged to censor users with abnormal body shapes, too many wrinkles, or whose environment...
Sam Smith.
or whose environment shows signs of poverty, such as cracks in the walls or old decorations.
Signs of poverty!
Right, exactly. Exactly.
Wow.
Your socioeconomic status is being analysed and downgraded.
people from lower socioeconomic status, you know, they don't have access to better education. They're already in like in difficult family situations. They already don't have support networks at home that where they can really realize their potential. Yeah. And so they find that online.
Exactly. And this is one of the key problems. It's these recommendation engines, recommending groups, recommending YouTube videos. I mean, one of the key engineers on the YouTube recommendation engine, they found that there was a problem with the algorithm because it was recommending content. And really, what it's designed to do, the YouTube recommendation engine is not designed to recommend you things that you want to view.
Hmm.
It's not doing that. You think it is, it's recommending content you want. No. Incorrect. What it's expressly trying to do is find a rabbit hole down which you are vulnerable to falling, and then it's trying to send you down it. So
I've often wondered that, because I've often wondered, like, look, why am I getting recommended douchebag YouTubers? Why the hell are they, out of everything that Gmail specifically and, you know, YouTube must know about me, right? Why are you giving me dumbass YouTubers sending me whatever? It's because they're monetized videos. If I watch their video, YouTubers, because I'm sorry guys, but for the most part, you're dumb and you're not educated and you just want to be famous. So you're full of bullshit content, right? You're just making shit up and you monetize your videos. You put adverts all over your videos, your dumb bullshit videos. So that's why YouTube want me to look at you. So when I put something in about psychology, of course I'm going to get some dumbass 25-year-old guru who's talking bullshit about self-enlightenment because his videos are monetized.
Yeah, but then also you'll get people, for example, conspiracy theories are a key example of this. Like, if it knows that you're interested in conspiracy theories, there have been studies that have shown that if you've searched for flat earth 35% of the time, 90% of the recommendations will be flat earth videos because it knows that you have a vulnerability.
You watch it.
Exactly.
It's not the content. It keeps you time on there.
Time on device is a term that started in the casino industry, and it's being used now as a metric in the social media industry.
No.
Yeah.
Time on device.
Time on the slot machine, pulling that arm.
So good. It's
the same thing when you scroll down, when you refresh that feed. Why do you think now you get a different thing at the top of the feed
every time? Every single time. Yeah, it's variable reward. It gives you just enough.
An intermittent variable reward schedule. And actually, there's documentaries on dating apps, and the CEO of Tinder literally says that's exactly how the platform works.
Now, I feel quite lucky because I've been off Tinder. I've never used it in London at all. Or, like, I used it once abroad and here and there, but it's never been something I've used.
Yeah, same.
And I feel very good about that. Not that I deliberately went out of my way not to use it. It's just that I never really started using it.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Because I guess, you know, I just never felt that it was... I just never needed it.
The same way I never smoked.
Right, exactly. I just never needed to do that. You know, meeting people was fine. It's fine.
Yeah.
But, oh my God, like, I'm so glad I missed that, dodge that bullet.
Yeah.
Because that's just insane. There's, like, there's got to be, like, a Tinder DNA pool right now of just all the same people who are going around in that, that same hideous sloppy circle. I mean, my God, man, you know what I mean?
Well, the version of this in Iceland has to account for the fact that people are genetically quite similar. So a social dating app in Iceland actually has to account for this.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
But it is something that, unlike our normal episodes when we're just kind of looking at a topic, I do kind of feel a way about this topic.
Actually, so do the heads of these technology companies.
Yeah.
You know, Steve Jobs famously told reporters that his kids don't use iPads and that we limit how much technology our kids use at home. Yeah, sorry, that was a quote. We limit how much technology our kids use at home, he says. The Facebook vice president of growth, he said, I can control my decision, which is that I don't use that shit. I can control my kids' decisions, which is that they're not allowed to use that shit either.
Exactly.
You know, the short-term dopamine-driven feedback loops that we've created are destroying how society works. Sean Parker, the founding president of Facebook, he was Justin Timberlake, I think, in the social media, social network.
I've got him on video.
Yeah. I mean, he basically says, God only knows what it's doing to our children's
brains. He knew what they were doing. He said that they knew what they were doing, and they did it anyway.
He's a conscientious objector now. Tony Fadell, he says we released a beast, but there's a lot of unintended consequences. He invented the iPod, and he was the inventor of the iPhone. He says we don't have the tools we need to understand what we do every day. We have zero data about our habits on our devices. And then Silicon Valley parents, finally. I mean, there's many modern Silicon Valley parents. They strongly restrict technology used at home. Mm. And some of the areas top schools minimize technology in the classroom. And in the words, I've got a quote here from a 44-year-old parent who used to work at Google. They said, we know at some point they will need to get their own phones, but we're prolonging it as long as possible. Give them a sense of what life was like before social media. That's what we have, and that's what you can do for your kids. You can give them a sense of what life was like before.
And you can do that on a Saturday morning. You can do that.
Yeah.
You know, you can make them only go observe, like, content from older means, like DVDs, or, you know, they have to select what they want to watch.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, don't just stick a tablet in front of them and say, see you later, sunshine. Enjoy your YouTube trip for the next day. It reminds me of a quote by Carl Sagan, man. He said that, like, we live in the era of science and technology, but nobody knows anything about science and technology. Yeah. And I think that, you know, we really live in the era of social media, and it's coming for you, and it's got you, and it's got a hold on you. You got to do more to know about it.
I mean, there's a quote at the beginning of The Social Dilemma that says, nothing vast enters the life of mortals without a curse. And that was from Sophocles. That's very true. There's another quote, which is, any technology that's sufficiently advanced is indistinguishable from magic.
Exactly. That's Arthur C. Clarke.
Yes, exactly.
I love that. Arthur C. Clarke's,
And we're now dealing with magic that's cursed. And we're not saying there's not any positives to this, but we need to regulate this. And what are the ways forward? How can we improve this? Well, I mean, look, you know, you can start by going cold turkey, but you don't need to do that. The immediate changes, you can turn off notifications that aren't people. You can go grayscale, so the pretty colors and the red notification icons aren't dragging your attention away. You can find this on the Center for Humane Technologies website. They give you this list. Keep your home screen to tools only.
Yeah,
that's made a big difference.
Put all your apps in a folder.
Yeah, exactly.
There's nothing
on
your home screen.
You don't need to see them. Launch other apps by typing into the search bar instead.
I do that.
Exactly.
That's good.
Charge your device outside of the bedroom. I still don't do that because I still...
I leave it outside every night, my room.
I need an alarm clock. Remove social media from your phone, which is exactly what we've done. Send audio notes or call instead of texting because of the lack of personalization and the...
Record a voice message.
Exactly.
And then they can't read what you're typing.
How many times have you thought, oh, I've spent a lot of time on my phone having a conversation over text that could have been done in 5 minutes over the phone?
That's so true. Yeah. Even texting versus an email. Like, even using your thumbs over four fingers on each hand.
Yeah.
It's such a waste of time by comparison.
If you do WhatsApp web... And you go on WhatsApp on web and you type using a keyboard.
Yep.
God, I feel like I'm responding too quickly.
Exactly.
With too much length.
That's
and then you phone them because it just seems weird to type these long messages.
That's it.
And then, use quick reactions to texts. So like when you see like things come in, like react to them. Give some like nonverbal cues. If you are going to do text, give some nonverbal cues.
Because it's like...
It's more like...
It's more like a...
Exactly. But phone people. And actually the app I downloaded was Siempo. Siempo, S-I-E-M-P-O. It's a launcher. So on Android, basically you can use... Like I have a Huawei and there's the Huawei launcher, or I can use Siempo as a launcher. So it's not exactly
an app. It's your OS. It's like your
operating
system.
Essentially my OS. And it protects you from distractions and mindless use because it replaces your home screen with an interface that allows you to batch notifications, unbrand all the icons, randomize their location, and set restrictions to prevent unconscious usage. And actually, it's really cool because you can put an intention in there. So I typed an intention to make time to read more.
Right.
And every time I unlock my phone, that intention comes up. And there's one page where my the apps I've flagged are listed. So all the apps like Facebook, and there's a little interface where they all live. Or lived in Facebook's regard, but like YouTube's on there, LinkedIn's on there.
Yeah.
And they're kind of grayed out. I can still click them, but at the top, it highlights my intention. And everything is in black and white. Everything's very vanilla. And I have stopped using my phone, exactly like you said earlier, when you get rid of social media. But when I've started using this particular operating system, I am using my phone so much less.
Yes.
It's not just social media. It's technology is trying to get us to spend time on the device.
You have to decide what relationship you want with it. This was, I recently got an iPad for my studies, just easier than carrying around than a laptop.
Mm.
But I made the decision from as soon as I turned it on, what apps were going on there.
Yeah.
Nothing is on there. There is literally just the Books app for reading. There's my Udemy app, so I can watch my coding courses.
Awesome.
The entire device is only for study. There's only Word on there. There's no video games on there. There's nothing on there that's not study.
Awesome. And it's an iPad.
And it's an iPad.
Yeah, because Apple is uniquely placed because they don't trade in adverts.
Exactly.
They actually sell trust and privacy. And there's problems with Apple, but they are uniquely placed.
They are far better
Yes.
than Google.
I'm no technophile.
For sure.
Exactly. Get an Apple, because when you use
especially
their maps,
if you're into privacy.
Exactly. If you use maps on Apple.
Oh yeah, they shred it. There's like a digital shredding thing. Not even they can retrace it.
Exactly.
And they don't sell to you. Based on your GPS.
You're paying through the nose, probably too much money to use that hardware. But what you're also paying for is trust and privacy.
That's it. Grayscaling really helps, like you mentioned. Yeah. But yeah, basically the thing is, guys, for me, what this boils down to is it's a fundamental question. It's not about whether or not you think, you know, you'll be depressed if you use Facebook too much, or you know, you'll be anxious if you spend too much screen time or any of that. For me, it just really boils down to, do you care about your behavior being modified and changed without your knowledge?
Yeah.
Do you care that companies are paying vast amounts of money to influence how you literally walk through the world?
Yeah.
Influence how you view the world, influence how you view your friends, influence basically every decision you make, as long as your hand and your eyes are on that unit. How much do you care about that? That's really the point.
Right. And yeah, hopefully we can all get clean together. But ultimately, it's not about individual responsibility, it's about regulation and change from above.
Totally.
It's all very well to put the responsibility on the individual, but you don't let people build nuclear power plants and then say it's our responsibility to have hazmat suits.
Exactly.
If there's slot machines outside your front door, you don't say, well, it's all individual personal responsibility. If there's shiny lights and slot machines everywhere, maybe we should regulate that.
Yep.
Maybe we should put parameters in place.
If your phone is coming preloaded with apps on it, then this has nothing to do with you, man. It's like, you know, we got to stop that.
Yeah.
You know, it's... but it can be done.
It can be done. Let's get clean.
Thanks for listening to Abstracts. Music, as always, was Coffee by Cambo. You can find that in the free music archive. Link is in the description. Also, if you want to get in touch, you can find us on our website, www.abstractpodcast.com. That is www.abstractpodcast.com. We are no longer on social media, so that is the way you can get hold of us. Thanks very much for listening. See you next time.